Well, please would you have in front of you the passage from Romans chapter 1 that we had read a little bit earlier. We begin a new series today in this magnificent letter of Paul to the church in Rome. And the book of Romans is a book that has had a powerful effect on the shape of Christian history. Down through the centuries, it has always been revered. It's been perhaps Paul's greatest and clearest statement of Christian theology. You think of somebody like an Augustine, for example. He was brought up in a Christian home, but as many teenagers do, unfortunately, he rebelled. It's not a new thing. And he wasn't at all interested in the faith of his parents. He heard the words of a child's game in the park, tole leg, tole leg, tole leg. And that means pick up and read. He picked up the New Testament and he happened to turn to Romans chapter 13 and verse 13 and was shaken awake by these words which convinced him that the life he was living was not acceptable to God. Because as he opened his Bible, he read, "Let us behave decently as in the daytime, not in orgies and drunkenness, not in sexual immorality and debauchery, not in dissension and jealousy." Augustine had had a good Christian upbringing, and those words hit him between the eyes, and he came and said sorry to God, convinced that his sin was offensive to him. Moving down the centuries, we come to a Martin Luther, who is most famously known for his association with the book of Romans. He became a monk out of a sincere desire to find God. He had a tormented soul, and he went through all sorts of spiritual disciplines, hoping that they would lead him to God. On one occasion, he was riding along on his horse, and he was hit by lightning. And he promised to God, "Save me, and I'll become a monk. I'll commit my life to serving you." And so his spiritual discipline and his activity began, but he still could not find peace with God. He studied diligently and got a PhD in the New Testament, became a professor in the University of Wittenberg, and he was preparing to preach on this book of the Bible, the book of Romans, to his students. And eventually he came to Romans chapter 1 and verse 17, in which he, in his preparations, read these words, "For in the gospel a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last, just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith." And Martin Luther speaks in his journal about the profound effect that verse had upon him, because he believed in a righteous God. He believed that God was out there, that God was holy, that God was just, that God was sovereign, that God was to be feared, separate completely from us. But as Martin Luther began to study this passage, he began to appreciate for the first time that this passage doesn't speak about God's righteousness, his distance from himself, from us. But rather it speaks about the righteousness which God gives to make the unrighteous right. It is the gift that he gives to make those who are not right in his sight, right before him. And he wrote, "When I understood that, and when the concept of justification by faith alone burst into my mind, suddenly it was like the doors of paradise swung open, and I walked through." Come a couple of centuries later to this country, and John Wesley speaks of his conversion experience was partly trying to understand Romans chapter 1. He walked into that meeting in Aldersgate, where his heart was strangely warmed. It was for the first time that he understood the good news about Jesus. What is it that makes this book so powerful? What is it that attracts preachers to preach on it? It is because it is a book that is preeminently about the gospel. The gospel, in a nutshell, is God's plan to make the unrighteous righteous. I don't know if you noticed in those first 17 verses, on six occasions, Paul uses the word the gospel. Paul talks about him being set apart for the gospel of Christ, the gospel of God, in verse 1. In verse 2, he talks about the promise of God beforehand to reveal the message of the gospel in the Son. In verse 9, he speaks about his preaching the gospel of the Son and his joy in serving God with that message. Verse 15, he speaks about his eagerness to preach the gospel to those who were at Rome. And verse 16, he speaks about the gospel being the power of God for salvation. And then verse 17, the gospel as a revelation of the righteousness of God. The gospel is a message about Jesus Christ, who calls us in grace to faith and obedience. There are three things about it, just very briefly, to orientate us this morning that are so important. The first is that salvation was promised by God, verse 2. God promised from the very beginning of time that he would raise up a saviour, ever since Adam and Eve fell first in the garden. There was a promise that one day God would make the unrighteous righteous by his provision. And the provision that he gave us to make us righteous was in the Son. Verse 17, it's a revelation of God providing righteousness in the Lord Jesus. And that was proved demonstrably in verse 4, we're told, by the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. The grave is empty. God says, yes, I accept that payment of Christ's righteousness to make you right with me. Now, Paul had never visited the church in Rome, but he clearly wants to do so. And who wouldn't? Rome was the centre of the then-known world. There was already a church in existence, and the great pioneering apostle is keen to go to the strategic place to make sure he meets the believers there who've come to faith. And he's on his way, of course, to Spain as well, he hopes, where he will bring the gospel further into Europe. But you would imagine, wouldn't you, that firstly here's a church that's been planted by others. Paul is writing from the city of Corinth, where his ministry is being constantly defamed by the teachers around. And he's going to this great center city. You would think it would be somewhat intimidating. And so Paul begins by setting out a couple of benchmarks for them, which I think we need to make a priority for ourselves. And those are both there in verses 16 and 17. Paul wants to say to them, first of all, that the gospel is nothing to be ashamed of. Now, you can probably think of various experiences in your own life which have caused you embarrassment or shame. And maybe the recollection of them just makes you shudder a little bit. So just to make you feel a bit less uncomfortable, I'll tell you about one of my most embarrassing experiences. When I left school and came to work in London, I was invited out to dinner. And on one occasion, it was with a chap who was trained to be a chef. And there were half a dozen of us at this dinner party. And we sat down to a very nicely decorated table, and the starter was prawns. And I still go pink with embarrassment when I think about it. The chap had very delicately peeled all these prawns, and he'd left one unpeeled prawn on the side of the dish. And I got down through all my prawns, and I wasn't exactly quite sure what to do with this chap sitting on the side of my plate, staring up with those little black eyes at me. So I took my heart in my hands and I lifted up the offending item and put the whole prawn in my mouth. And I chewed and I chewed and I chewed. I asked for a third glass of water. I drank and drank and I ate about three quarters of a French loaf of bread. And I eventually went and got it down. And I hadn't really noticed, apart from the fact that that wasn't the thing to do, that the other five people around the table were just looking at me as if wondering where this backward person from Jersey had come from. And whenever I see a prawn, it sort of brings out those horrifying memories as I think about it. Shameful, awful, a social faux pas. Well, I have more shameful experiences that I wouldn't share in public, and no doubt you do too, where we think of ways in which we're embarrassed and humiliated. Now, Paul is talking here about the impact of the message of Jesus Christ, and he's saying that for many people, this is a shameful thing. For the gospel is offensive to our religious sensibilities, and many people are embarrassed and ashamed by this message. Let me just give you an illustration. I mean, imagine for a moment that you are a member of the All England Tennis Club. Imagine that you are privileged enough to get tickets every year to send to court, and that you are used to using that privilege, and you hardly bat an eyelid about what those privileges mean to you personally. But imagine on one occasion that you're coming there for the semi-finals of Wimbledon Tennis Four Night, and you go to the gate, and the usher says, I'm sorry, but you haven't got tickets today. And he proceeds to walk to the very back of the queue and start giving out all the tickets free of charge. I would imagine you would be slightly upset about that. Your privilege being thrown back in your face, and these little upstarts who've been camping out, getting them, and not even having to pay for them. How humiliating it would be for you. Or imagine that you've had your name on the waiting list to be a member of Wimbledon Park Golf Course for years. You've remortgaged your house so that you can afford to join. And the membership secretary starts wandering around the pitch and putt and starts beckoning people off the pitch and putt and says, "Yeah, don't stop messing about on that little course there. Come and have a round on the golf course here and do feel free to use it whenever you want." Shameful! What an awful thing to do. Wouldn't you be just slightly annoyed if that went on? Well, Paul says that those feelings of shame are often experienced by people when they consider the gospel of Jesus Christ. Paul must have written this because he must have at least had a hint of temptation to at times be ashamed of this message. For this message really offers the same grace that was being offered by the steward at Wimbledon or at the golf course. It is going to those who are unworthy and offering them free of charge the gospel, the good news, righteousness from God. And to those who thought that they'd been earning it all their life, this came as a great slap in the face. And so Paul could quite understandably, as he prepares to go to Rome, feel at least a bit of temptation to be slightly embarrassed by this message. Now, I suggest that you feel that too. I know that I feel it. I go to people with religious sensibilities and say to them that actually your niceness, your religiosity, is of no value, because the only way you'll be made right with God is through the free gift of the Son. There's nothing you can do for it. And God went to the back of the line to the Gentiles and offered it to them free of charge. And understandably, those with a great Jewish heritage would be offended. Now, in this context, I think about our own society, which in many ways has lost its sense of shame. The list of sins that are mentioned in chapter 118 and following, look at next week, are almost paraded in the media daily. And yet we continue to be ashamed by this message, kind of topsy-turvy. We're embarrassed by the good news of Jesus, but yet don't seem to blush at the awful immorality around us. Religious people will be scandalized by this gospel. But Paul believes that it is powerful. And that's the second thing he says here. This gospel is the power of God for salvation. Now, you probably well know that the word in the Greek, dunamis, is the same word which we get the English word dynamite. Some of you may have come across a chap called V.J. Menon, who I'm hoping will come and speak with us at some point next year. He is a very effervescent, enthusiastic evangelist. He became a Christian as a result of going to services at St. Helens Bishopsgate and had a very strongly religious Hindu background. And now he goes around public schools in our country telling the boys to hear the gospel of Jesus Christ. Anyway, on one occasion he was going through customs, and only V.J. could do this, and he was asked by the customs officer whether he had anything to declare. And V.J. picked up his briefcase and said, "Yes, I have some dynamite." And you can imagine he was very swiftly surrounded by angry-looking officers, and he opened up his briefcase and took out the Bible. He said, "This is dynamite. You read this and it will blow your mind." Well, he's lucky he wasn't locked up. But the word dunamis in the Bible is not so much the idea of blowing up, of actually exploding, but it's the idea of getting the job done, powerful to cause the effect, to to produce the result. When we moved into our house as a curate in Carlisle, we had an old enamel-stained bath. And the sight of the stains on it sort of didn't make you feel a whole lot cleaner once you got out. So we went around the supermarket, and my eye was caught by a sign next to Ajax saying, "Power to shift deep down stains." So we took it back and liberally sprinkled it over the bath, and with a couple of bottles of elbow grease as well, continued to scrub and scrub in the hope they'd go away. But it didn't, and we ended up getting a new bathroom suite. But my question was, when I went around the shelf, is the same question I have when I think about the gospel of Jesus, which is, can it do the job? Is it powerful to do what it promises? Paul is coming to Rome eager to spend his time speaking about Jesus Christ, because that message about Jesus can make the unrighteous righteous. It gets the job done. The righteousness from God imputed to those who are not righteous. And it came like a thunderbolt to Luther. And it should continue to be a sense of wonder to us. This is God's answer for unrighteousness. Christianity, as somebody has said, is not primarily do. Do, 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 do. Be good, be nice. But rather, done. It was done by God at the cross. And it is offered to you as a free gift. I still think about ways that I may be ashamed in my ministry, and I wonder whether you resonate with these. I think of times when I don't speak up for the uniqueness of Jesus, when I don't speak out for or live myself a morally upright life that's pleasing to him. I think of ways in which I might doubt his power, that I do all sorts of other things in the activities of the life of the church that don't put the power of the gospel first. And I put my confidence in all sorts of things to try to sort out my life, to try to build a church that don't have the message of Jesus Christ at the centre. But as Paul prepares to go to this church in the centre of the then-known world, he wants to put first of all the gospel, for he's not ashamed of it, and he believes that it is powerful. Spurgeon, apparently on one occasion, took his students to see a wonderful painting of Christ on the cross. And he said to his students, what do you see as you look at the canvas? And the students would say things like, well, I see the agony of Jesus hanging there on the cross. I see the soldiers jeering and shedding out his clothes. I see Mary in her sorrow. The two men either side. And Spurgeon said to them, look again, what do you see? And they thought, and they wondered, and Spurgeon said, you've not understood the cross until you see yourself hanging there. For he stood in for you and me, the righteous Son of God, in the place of the unrighteous. And as we look at the cross, we see a crucified Saviour and ourselves hanging there. I see me. The gospel gets the job done, so don't be ashamed of it. It is God's remedy.